We've now covered chapter 15, which was simply the setup and the buildup for the seven bowl judgments. And those were all given to us in chapter 16. We saw mainly there the seventh bowl judgment. That was sort of the feu d'enfant, the grand finale of all of those judgments. It was the second coming of Christ, the return of Christ, accompanied by natural cataclysms that devastate and level the earth. We see also there as a part of that seventh bowl judgment that the Battle of Armageddon takes place at that time, the second coming of Christ, and he sort of puts an end to that. And we got all of that in very concise summary statements. John didn't give us much detail. Most of that was just one verse statements about what was happening. Those were placeholders to keep us in the timeline, to show us what he was talking about in the timeline. And so now what John is going to do, he's going to take the next three chapters, chapter 17, chapter 18, and chapter 19, to give us the microscopic up close and detailed view of mainly that seventh trumpet judgment. There'll be a little more information thrown in there as we go, but mainly this is John taking those three verses, Revelation chapter 16, four verses actually, verses 17 through 21, and now giving us a three-chapter close-up of those four verses. Chapter 17 today, we're going to be studying Religious Babylon toppled, the fall of religious Babylon. Next week, Lord willing, chapter 18, John is going to give us the up close and detailed view of economic Babylon being toppled by the Lord. And then, of course, chapter 19, our favorite chapter in the book of Revelation, John's recording of the second coming of Christ and everything that surrounds that. Now, in that sense, and in the strictest sense, that means that the next three chapters that we're studying, 17, 18, and 19, it's not perfectly chronological, right? Because you kind of got the whole thing in Revelation 16, and now John has come back with the microscope, and he's going to give us that last seventh trumpet all over again, but he's going to give it to us in detail, three chapters. However, in my opinion, it's all stuck together so tightly and neatly that I have no problem still considering this to be chronological, because this is just the Bible's way, and we should be used to it by now. If you started reading the Bible, you saw it right away. The Lord gives us, in the Genesis account of creation, Genesis chapter 1, he gives us a three-verse summary of the creation of mankind, Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 through 30. And what's the next chapter? Genesis chapter 2. That's the microscopic, that's the up-close and detailed account of the creation of mankind. No, he didn't create mankind twice. He didn't scrap that first batch. No, he created mankind once. He gave us a summary statement. Then he gives us the up-close and detailed viewpoint of that summary statement. Same thing here. Revelation chapter 16, verses 17 through 21, the summary statement that brings us to the end. Now, Revelation chapter 17, 18, and 19, the up-close and detailed account of those four-verse summary statements that John gave us. So we'll only have time today to take Revelation 17, if that. We may not even get through the chapter. Religious Babylon toppled. Supposing that we get through that, we'll take chapter 18 next week, economic Babylon toppled. And because this is the details of summary that we've already been given, you can expect that in this study, there's going to be repetition. Of course there will be, but that's okay. It is complex stuff to understand, and the best way to understand complex stuff is repetition, of course. So let's strap in, buckle down, and go ahead and begin reading verse 1 of chapter 17. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot." Now, verse 5 tells us that this harlot is Babylon the Great. Keep that in mind. This harlot is Babylon the Great, who sits on many waters. And we don't know for sure which angel this is. We only know that it is definitely one of the seven angels that have poured out one of the bowls of God's wrath upon the earth. If I had to venture a guess, I would guess that the angel that is giving John this message and this tour through this spiritual vision is the seventh angel that poured out the seventh bowl. And the reason I say that is because what are we studying in the chapter? The fall of religious Babylon. And when did that take place? The seventh bowl judgment. When that seventh angel poured out that seventh bowl judgment, Babylon fell. We read about it in that one verse. So it makes sense to me that it would be this seventh angel that poured out that seventh bowl and watched Babylon fall. It makes sense to me that it would be him who comes to John and says, John, come along on this journey. I want to show you what happened when I poured out that bowl of God's wrath. Now, regardless of exactly which one it is, sufficient for the study is the fact that an angel has visited John and invited John along on this spiritual journey. He is going to get a spiritual vision, and he is going to get to see the downfall of Babylon. Now, we know that it is a spiritual vision simply based upon the fact that what John is seeing here is all given to us in metaphors. He's not seeing the actual events unfolding in real time here. He is seeing spiritual symbolism that is given to him in the form of a vision, and then he's going to use that to teach us truth, give us details about these events that he's speaking about in the chapter. So verse 3 will tell us that John gets carried away in the Spirit, which means John was definitely Pentecostal. Get it? Because he got carried away in the Spirit, and Pentecostals tend to, well, he gets carried away in the Spirit, and you'll notice our translators have capitalized the word Spirit, capital S. That means they believe that he was carried away in the Holy Spirit, and I would agree to that. This is the Spirit taking him on a spiritual vision, a spiritual tour of the judgment, the action taken by the Lord against this harlot, Babylon the Great. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Now, there really doesn't need to be any confusion about who this great harlot is. John refers to her more often than not as the harlot or a harlot, verse 1, verse 5, verse 15, verse 16. But in verse 5, John identifies the harlot as Babylon the Great. And that's a piece of the puzzle, but that's only a piece of the puzzle, okay? We know the harlot is Babylon the Great, but what is Babylon? What does that mean? Well, fortunately for us, we have spent quite a bit of time interpreting many of the pieces, not just that one, but many of the pieces that we're going to find in this chapter. And that is going to help us out quite a lot today, because what I'm going to be able to do is give you quick answers. And if you've been in those studies, no problem, you'll get it and we can move on. And if you haven't, if you don't fully understand the answers that I give you, well, then guess what? You can go to anchoredfellowship.com in your free time, and you can go backtrack through all of those necessary past studies in the book of Revelation that we have done, and then you'll be caught up to speed. And then this study of chapter 17 will make sense to you, which means you're going to have to listen to this one again too. Sorry. So in short order then, because we've already studied these things, in short order, the Babylon of Revelation chapter 17, the great harlot, is, no one answering, it is man-made false religion that counterfeits the Lord's genuine article of salvation. And it is any and all false religion. Any religion that sleeps around on the Lord, so to speak. Any religion that runs out on him. Any false religion, any false system of spirituality, the Lord would say, harlot and Babylon. Two words that he would assign to that kind of system. Now, we will be able to develop that as we move along in the text. Just make sure that outside of this text, you don't always assume that when the Lord says Babylon, that he is referring to a false religious system. That's not always going to be the case biblically. You have to understand how the Lord uses the word Babylon. This is repetition, but it's good for us. How does he use the word Babylon? Well, you could replace that word Babylon with the word rebellion, and you'd pretty much hit the nail right on the head. This all goes back to Genesis chapter 11, when a Nimrod named Nimrod decided to build up a civilization separate from God. He wanted to build up this city and make a name for the city. He wanted this civilization to sprout up, and he didn't want God to have any part of it. And what did the Lord do to that system? This was the Tower of Babel. And what did the Lord do? He toppled the tower, just as he's going to topple Babylon here in this chapter. Now, Babel eventually becomes known as Babylon. And from that time forward, that becomes a nickname scripturally that the Lord will assign to any system, any group of people. He even called the Jews at times Babylon when they were rebellious against him. He will assign that name to any false or rebellious system or people group that wants to do things apart from God, separate from God. Now, if it's not already true, if we're not careful, it will be true before too long that the Lord could rightfully call America Babylon just as well, because for many years there's been this struggle in this country to get God out of here, get him out of public life, take prayer out of school, take the scriptures out of school, don't teach creation, insert evolution, even though it doesn't make sense and it can't be proven, even though it's a religion in and of itself. So there's been that push, right? And if we're not careful, God could very easily assign that word Babylon to America. And that's why many of us are investing our lives and fighting for the heart and soul of this country, that we don't do that, that we don't back out and run out on the Lord and become a system like this that the Lord is speaking of in Revelation chapter 17, because its fate doesn't look too good, does it? So you have to think of the word Babylon as a synonym for rebellion. And if you do that, you're in good shape. If you don't, if you miss that biblically, then you're going to be very confused. When we get to Revelation 18 next week, it's 11:11, maybe the week after, or the week after that one, you're going to be confused. When we get to Revelation 18 and you read about what? The downfall of Babylon. You're going to say, wait a minute, didn't this already happen? Revelation chapter 7, didn't we already study the downfall of Babylon in Revelation chapter 17? Yes, we did. Religious Babylon. In other words, the religious rebel. So chapter 18 is going to be a focus on economy, or the political aspect of this end time kingdom, if you prefer. So it's going to be economic rebel that falls next week. So the Lord is using that word in that way, and you need to know that in order to not be confused. Now, once again, ground that we have already covered, John, as the Lord inspires him to write this passage, is using fornication and drunkenness as spiritual metaphors. Fornication is sexual unfaithfulness, and that would be, in this passage, the equivalent to spiritual unfaithfulness. Drunkenness is what? The loss of control, the loss of senses, the loss of inhibition. So what would that be in spiritual terms? What's the Lord doing with it in the chapter? He's using it to speak about spiritual deception. That's what happens when a person is spiritually deceived. They lose their senses. They lose their inhibitions, and they end up going all in for a false religion. So in that sense, spiritual deception closely mirrors or mimics drunkenness. And you probably know some people that are spiritually deceived. And it's true, they just lose their senses. You can't reason with them. We've talked about it quite a bit here in this fellowship. I constantly have these debates online with people that just cannot come to sense. And we've well established here, what is that? It's not that they're not intelligent. It's not that they can't reason or logic. It is that they are spiritually deceived. There are demonic spirits that have led their minds to believe what they're believing, and there is no amount of sense or reason or logic that will talk them out of it. They just can't see it, because deception works according to the individual's will. If you don't want to see the truth, you won't be able to see the truth by the time you're in this thing long enough, right? Deception kicks in, and you are incapable of coming to the knowledge of the truth. Just remember that when you're debating with people online. Truth sometimes is incapable when deception is involved. Now, what is the reach of religious Babylon's influence here in Revelation chapter 17? Verse 1 said, she sits on many waters. That's Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, Mediterranean Sea, any body of water that you can name. This spiritual system, this false religion, it has a headquarters set up somewhere nearby, you can be sure enough. In verse 2, she has committed fornication with the kings of the earth and the inhabitants of the earth. So from the palace to the poorhouse, from Wall Street to Main Street, from ruler to commoner, people all over the world are in bed with her. People all over the world have been deceived by her. She, this false religion, according to verse 2, is complicit in the destruction of many societies, and she was and will be complicit in the corruption of every corrupt government in world history. That's not just a mistake that corruption happens in government. That is spiritually inspired. That's why that happens. Verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. Now, you know, when the New King James Version translates with that word wilderness, it's talking about the desert. We think of it differently. A wilderness to us is like woods and streams, maybe a cabin, that kind of thing. A wilderness in the New King James Version translation is a desert. So he carried me away in the spirit into the desert, and that's what false religion is. It is a desert. It is dry and barren. There is no life whatsoever within false religion. It gives you that false sense of security, that false sense of superiority. But there is no life in false religion. If Christ is not in it, if he's not of it, if it's not all about him, then there is no life in there. It's nothing more than a poor counterfeit of true spiritual life. Reading on. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, and this beast was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Have you ever noticed that the Lord likes to use the woman as a metaphor for spiritual or religious systems in the Bible? Did you notice that? In Galatians 4, Hagar was used as a metaphor for the covenant of law. Sarah was used as a metaphor for the covenant of grace. Just in Revelation alone, in Revelation chapter 12, remember the woman clothed with the sun? She was used as a metaphor to represent the nation of Israel. Here in Revelation chapter 17, verse 3, we see this woman is used to represent all false religions, specifically the final unification of all false religions. And in Revelation chapter 21, the Lord will use a woman, the bride of Christ, to what? To represent the final amassing of all the saints. Why does the Lord always use the woman as the metaphor for religious or spiritual systems? It's because the woman uniquely has the ability to produce children. Now, I know that's not popular to say in our society, but it's still biologically true. That's biology 101. The woman can have a child and the man cannot. And religion is just like that. Whether it's the one true religion of Christianity or whether it is false religions. Those religions tend to propagate and perpetuate largely through birth, the handing down to the next generation, the raising up of the next generation into that religion. If it's Christianity, if it's centered around Christ, if it's theologically sound, you've done a good thing by raising your children in that. But if not, if it's a false religion, oh man, awful, terrible, because now that is tough to get out of the heart. Once you believe something, it is tough to get out of the heart. So that's the comparison, I think. I believe that is why the Lord uses the woman as the metaphor in most occasions. But back to this woman, this harlot, Babylon, this godless, rebellious, false religious system. She is sitting on a scarlet red beast. Who's the beast? Repetition. Here we go. Who is the beast? Every time you read about a beast or the beast in the book of Revelation, it is referring to the Antichrist. Every time, there's only one occasion where another beast is referred to, and that is Revelation chapter 13, verse 11. And that other beast that John is speaking about, he very clearly and plainly tells us who it is. That other beast is the false prophet. But a beast or the beast, it is always going to be the Antichrist. This beast having seven heads and 10 horns kind of puts you in mind of the Hydra from Greek mythology, although the one that Godzilla battled only had 3 heads, I think. That's kind of the image here of the Antichrist, this dragon-like thing with many heads, 7 heads and 10 horns. And we have gone into this multiple times, so I'll spare you the lengthy discourse. Suffice it to say, the 7 heads place Antichrist in history. He will be the 7th and final of the 7th global of the 7 global world leaders. And then the 10 horns show us what his kingdom, that 7th and final global world empire, will consist of. It will consist of 10 kings. And we're going to read about this shortly. So sufficient for right now. In this part of the study, those 10 kings, those 10 heads are 10 kings that will join a 10 king or 10 nation confederation, and they will turn their power over to the Antichrist. That's what his kingdom will consist of, 10 nation confederation that he rules over. Verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So first of all, she wears purple. That is the color of royalty. She wears that because she has royal influence. Secondly, she wears scarlet, just as the beast was a scarlet. Isn't that cute? They match. She wears scarlet rather than white because she is not pure. She is impure, and she has power, and she is bloody with that power. The saints wear what? White always, because the saints are pure, purified by Christ. She is adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls because she has tremendous wealth. This false religious system, during the time of the tribulation, it is wealthy. It is influential. It is powerful. And she uses all of that, her royal influence, her bloody power, and her tremendous wealth to seduce and coerce the world into drinking from her cup. And what's in her cup? Abomination. That is detestable perversions of that which is right in the sight of God. And fornication, again, that is spiritual unfaithfulness to God. This is not an orthodox church, in other words. This is an unorthodox church. This is not a theologically sound group. This is a group with a whole bunch of corrupt mixture in the belief system, idolatry, false gods, false beliefs. That's what's all in this cup. She's kind of like the adulterous woman that Solomon spoke to us about in Proverbs. You know, she's perfumed up, she's decked out, she's dressed to kill. She's on every street corner trying to take in customers. She's in today just about every streaming platform. She's in just about every secular song. It's like the siren song singing to the world, trying to delude and deceive and persuade and coerce into corruption. And one after another, during the tribulation, they will enter her dwelling. And Solomon tells us there in Proverbs chapter 7, verse 27, that her dwelling is the path to hell, descending to the chambers of death. So she's attractive, she's appealing, she's powerful, she's influential, she seems to have a lot to offer, and yet she is bad news, really bad news, so don't get lured in by her. Verse 5, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great. Look at those words carefully. Mystery Babylon the Great. There is a mystery about this. There is more than meets the eye. That's how we know we're not talking about literal Babylon, which today would be Iraq. That's how we know we're not talking about a literal city here. We're talking about a spiritual city. We're talking about a spiritual name, a metaphor, symbolism, in which we've already defined. Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. So, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, that would seem to differentiate between Old Testament saints and New Testament saints. That tells me that this harlot, she's been around the block a few times. She's been around for a while. She was around in Old Testament times, and she's around in New Testament times. Now, the reason I say that is because it eliminates the possibility that the harlot Babylon from Revelation chapter 17 is exclusively the Roman Catholic Church. That is what is most commonly taught concerning this chapter, chapter 17. And you'll see some of the correlations and connections that they try to make between the text and the church, the Roman Catholic Church. But the system that we're examining, this fallen false system, John just told us it is not limited to after Christ and after the formation of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church wasn't around in Old Testament times. And we're going to see some more proof of this as we go, but this tells me that it could not possibly be the Roman Catholic Church exclusively. Now, it could be the case that during the tribulation, the Roman Catholic Church is the container organization for this ungodly marriage of all world religions into this one monstrous false religion. The Pope himself very recently was calling for this very thing. He was calling for all religions to come together, to forget their differences, and to be inclusive. He was even calling for the Christians and those of Islam to lay down their differences and come together in this thing called Chrislam. You probably heard that. That was a legitimate thing that happened. He was calling for that. Now, as much as we want to be all-inclusive, we still have to be truthful. And when it comes to salvation, Jesus wasn't very inclusive. He was exclusive. He said, there's one way, and I'm it. Oh, not me, Jesus, his words. Believe me, I'm not it. Follow me and you might be disappointed. Follow him and you won't. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. So as much as we want to be inclusive, we have to tell the truth. We can't just join up with other religions and call it good. and assume that everyone's, they've selected a path a little bit different than mine, but all paths lead to God. Well, they might, but some lead to God for salvation and others lead to God for judgment. So just be careful which path that you're on. Now, even if we were to say that unequivocally this is the Roman Catholic Church, that should not feel like Catholic bashing. Because may I remind you of the setting that we're studying. Revelation chapter 4, all true believers are raptured off of the planet. So, I believe with all my heart that even though the Catholic Church deviates greatly in many doctrinal areas from sound biblical doctrine, I believe with all my heart there are many good Catholic souls that are truly saved. Because regardless of what they're taught, regardless of what's being sung or chanted or stated in those Catholic services, they believe the truth in their heart that they are saved by faith in Jesus alone, not by works, not by prayer beads, not by statues of saints, not by prayers to saints, not by prayers to Mary, but they believe the truth. And so they will be saved. Many Catholics will be saved. If you didn't know that, you better come to grips with that. It's true. Many good Catholics will be saved. So when Revelation chapter 4 happens and the rapture takes place and all Christians, all true Christians are taken up to be with the Lord in heaven, what does that leave behind? Well, I think there's a lot of people in the Catholic Church that will not go to heaven because they're not truly saved. They're invested in a religion. That's sort of what their hope is. It's in the prayer beads, it's in the statues, it's in the chants, it's in the spiritism, the prayers to Mary and the prayers to saints. And I think there's many, many people in the Catholic Church that will not be saved and will not be taken up in the rapture. So what does that leave behind? That leaves behind a powerful, wealthy, and influential organization, and all of the true saved that were once a part of it, they are gone. So you're left with corruption and power, and you better believe that if that is the case, Satan is going to leverage that. He is going to leverage that powerful religion, which whatever's left will be a false religion. He is going to leverage that powerful false religion to bring about his agenda during the tribulation, which is largely that all things work out so that he rules in an uncontested manner over the entire earth. So just take a look at what the Catholic Church is right now. A powerhouse. And imagine that Catholic Church with only corruption remaining in it. Same goes, of course, for the rest of the world. All of the good influence, all of the purity, all of the soundness of doctrine, all of the truly saved are gone, and all that's left behind is corruption. And the Catholic Church will be uniquely positioned to leverage that. Now, lest you think I'm picking on the Catholic Church, I think there are going to be way more church organizations that don't stop when the rapture takes place. The ideal would be that everyone that attends church on a weekly basis, or a biweekly basis for some of us radicals, everyone that attends church is genuinely saved. And then when the rapture takes place, man, this is gone and the world can have it. This building's empty. We're all gone. But let's be realists. We know that not everyone that graces the church pew on a Sunday morning or Wednesday night is genuinely saved. So some of those churches, and some more so than others, when the rapture takes place, there's going to be membership left behind, and God forbid, even leadership left behind. And I think most of those churches will continue existing. So it's not just the Catholic Church. It's anything that's left behind, any religious or spiritual organization left behind after the rapture, having missed the rapture. Verse 7, "But the angel said to me, 'Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the 10 horns. So this angel's going to give us some answers. That's great. I want to point out that if there was any doubt about who was steering the beast, the Antichrist, verse 7 has just resolved that. Verse 3, the harlot was sitting on the beast, but verse 7 is pretty clear. It is the beast that is carrying her. He is controlling her. She's just going along for the ride. He is taking her wherever he wants to go. In other words, he is using her. The Antichrist will use this powerful false religion. He will use this, of course, that is the main function of the false prophet. He's going to spearhead that movement. He's going to bring all religions into one bloated, ungodly, monstrous religion. And Antichrist is going to use her to come to power. And he is going to use her through the leadership of the false prophet to persuade the world to get on board with his agenda. And once he does that, we're going to find out before the chapter is done, he will turn on her. He will ditch her just like that. He will have used that harlot, Babylon, the false religious system. And once he gets what he wants, power and control, he's going to ditch her. I hate to say it, but it's just kind of like the way of the politician. You appeal to the religious. You get their vote. And once you get their vote, now this doesn't happen with every president, but man, history tells us, more often than not, it does. Once you get that religious vote, who cares about the religious? You don't need them anymore. In fact, they may work against your agenda. The same is going to be true for the Antichrist. He's going to get that religious vote. He's going to get that religious support. That's going to help to propel him into power. But once he gets into power, he's going to realize he doesn't need that anymore. And he doesn't want there to be any competition for his rule. And he doesn't want to be influenced by religion at all. So he will discard her. And we'll read about that in more detail shortly or next week. Verse 8. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition or hell, waste. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Okay, once again, repetition. We have covered this quite thoroughly when we were in Revelation 13 building a profile of the Antichrist. We reached ahead to this story in order to get the full picture. Now we're in Revelation 17, and we're going to reach back into Revelation 13 to get the story. We're kind of working in reverse. And hopefully some of that we studied in Revelation 13 is still in your brain somewhere. But if not, I'll brief through this. This statement, the beast that was and is not and yet is a very peculiar statement. And it is a very precise statement. It leaves room for only one possible interpretation. Now, if it said that the beast was and was not and yet is, then we would go, okay, we get it. He was alive, then he died, and now he's alive again. It was a resurrection of some sort. Perfect sense. We'd get it. The same thing could be said of Christ. He was and was not. He died and is. He rose again. Resurrection. But it doesn't say that, does it? It says that the beast was, that is, he did live, and is not, that means he is no longer alive, and yet he is. He is living. He did live. He is not living, and yet he is living. Now, how could that be possible? Revelation 13, in our study, there's only one way that is possible, and that is if that beast has his spirit depart his body, but his body remains clinically and physically alive, and then his body is inhabited by another being. I know it's a tricky thought, but hang there with me for just a moment. So the interpretation, as I am forced to see it from the scriptures, is that Revelation 13, verse 3, Antichrist appears to be assassinated or wounded in battle, and he was not physically and clinically dead. The scriptures tell us that it was as if, in quotations, it was as if he was mortally wounded. What does mortally wounded mean? Wounded to death. So it was as if he was mortally wounded. But then that same verse goes on to tell us his deadly wound was healed. So it looked like a mortal wound, but it wasn't. It didn't kill him. It was just a deadly wound, and he survived it. Now, we add what we learn in Revelation 17 now. And there is only one way that this works, and here's how I see it. His body is kept alive, but his spirit, speaking about Antichrist here, his spirit leaves his body and goes into perdition, goes into hell, and it is at that time with an empty body just sitting there waiting to be taken because it's still alive, and it is at that time that the dragon, Satan, will inhabit his body. He's pulling off a counterfeit of Jesus Christ. Jesus was God incarnate, God in the flesh, and this would be Satan, wrong place, Satan incarnate, Satan in the flesh. And the world is going to see that and they're going to marvel. That means they're going to be overwhelmed with this incredulous thing that they're seeing. Is this too good to be true? This guy was dead. That's what it's going to look like. And that's how the false prophet is going to sell it. This guy was dead, and now he's alive again. He resurrected. He is the guy. He's the man. I'm following that guy. What a guy. I'll follow him into hell if that's what's necessary. And of course, that will be the case. Those who follow the Antichrist, that is exactly where they will be following him. But what really happened here was that the dragon that was in the first part of Antichrist's rule, just influencing him, he is now completely in control. He's in the driver's seat, and I believe Antichrist's spirit won't even be in his body at this time. So it may be a human body at the latter half of the tribulation for the Antichrist, but it certainly will not be completely human. The controls won't be human. The body will, but the controls won't. Same thing could be said for Jesus. The body was human, but the controls, the spirit in that body was not. It was Christ. And in this case, I believe it's going to be Satan incarnate, Satan in the flesh. Verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom. It's 11:41. What time did I say we're going to stop? 11:55, I think that's what I said. Verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Okay, now a lot of people will use this verse to quote unquote prove that Babylon, the great harlot in Revelation chapter 17, is none other than the Roman Catholic Church, because Rome is the only city in the world that has ever been referred to as the city on seven hills. And it is true that that word, that Greek word oros, can mean both mountains and hills. So they say that's it. It's talking about the Roman Catholic Church. But anchored, read this very closely. The text itself tells us otherwise. The seven heads of the beast are the seven mountains. We're not talking about seven literal physical mountains here. The seven heads of the beast are the seven mountains. So if we know what the seven heads of the beast are, we already have the definition for these seven mountains. Now, it is possible there's double meaning here, but if that is the case, there is not enough here to definitively tell me that this woman, this harlot, this religious Babylon is exclusively the Roman Catholic Church. Though, again, I admit it is not difficult to see how the Roman Catholic Church is really the only organization right now big enough and powerful enough to gain control over all other religions. But here's what we do know. Daniel is extremely clear about what the seven heads of the beast are. Very clear about that. And whatever they are, That's what the seven mountains are. Daniel tells us those seven heads of the beast are the seven world empires throughout all of history.